Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Some of the strange twists coming out of the Middle East today include leader Muammar Gaddafi of Libya saying that al-Qaeda chief Osama bin Laden is behind the uprising in Libya and that al-Qaeda followers give young Libyans hallucinogenic pills in their coffee to get them to revolt. Gaddafi actually said this, according to the AP this morning. It's also being reported that Zimbabwe, under Robert Mugabe, is sending arms to Gaddafi to help him stay in power. So after all else is said and done, who knows, it may be that Gaddafi and Mugabe are the last dictators standing. But there is more to the Middle East than the unrest in North Africa and the Gulf, and our next guest knows more than most. Steve Call is president of the New America Foundation. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. And in this week's issue, he writes that the Obama administration has been entering into direct secret discussions with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Call is the author of books, including The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. So maybe he knows something about those alleged hallucinogen distribution networks. He's writing a book now on oil, so he's well placed to talk about a lot of what's going on right now. Afghanistan, Libya, and the new oil aftershocks from the Middle East. Steve Call, hi, welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, great to be back with you.
And let's start with the Taliban and your article in The New Yorker this week. These latest talks enter into the annals of the late Richard Holbrooke's diplomatic achievements, as you describe them, and you describe the talks as exploratory. Tell us what that means.
Well, I think the Americans are trying to discover whether there are senior Taliban leaders who would be willing, under acceptable conditions, to enter into formal peace negotiations or political settlement negotiations with the Afghan government this year. And there's been efforts to answer that question made by the Karzai government and indirect American and European participation in those back-channel talks. But I think the Americans decided correctly that they needed to assess this for themselves. And there are some issues of concern to the Taliban, such as the status of Taliban prisoners in Guantanamo and the future of international forces in Afghanistan that really only the Americans can address anyway. So that's the idea. I think what was interesting, one of the things that was interesting in reporting this was the sense that finally, after a fair amount of circular talk about political tracks in Afghanistan, the Obama administration is really thinking that 2011 is the year when they really want to turn in that direction.
How do they know who to talk to in the Taliban? Isn't it a pretty decentralized network?
It is, but there is a formal, it is decentralized, and that's an important thing to understand about it. At the same time, there is a leadership group informally known as the Quetta Shura that conforms more or less to and sees itself as the government in exile of the Taliban government that ruled Afghanistan between 1996 and 2001, and which was shattered and scattered by the U.S.-led invasion, but more or less reconstituted across the border in Pakistan and has a formal shura, a leadership shura, that is notionally loyal to Mullah Omar, but which also has portfolios within it. So you're in charge of defense and you're in charge of media and finance and so on. It's in that group, the Quetta Shura, that these back channels with the Karzai government have emerged, certain personalities there. There's a question, though, about whether these are people who speak for the group, speak for themselves, speak for part of the group. That's always been a mystery. I think it's probably still uncertain.
And what would the United States actually be looking for in any negotiation with the Taliban? I mean, I think we should keep in mind that the reason the United States is in Afghanistan is to weaken al-Qaeda's ability to stage something like another 9/11 attack. So if you accept that premise, what would a U.S. peace treaty with the Taliban do for that goal of U.S. national homeland security?
Yes, well, in order to achieve the goal you just described, which I think is the heart of the Obama administration's policy, the administration judges that it cannot allow the Taliban to return to power, and it cannot allow the Taliban to control territory in a way that would allow al-Qaeda to establish camps or other facilities that had international potential. So that was why we threw the Taliban out of office in the first place, this line of thinking goes, and it's why we must prevent them from returning to power. Now, if you visit Kabul today, you can very easily visit other Taliban leaders who have already come in from the cold and who have made political deals, mostly back in 2004, 2005, when Zalmay Khalilzad was the U.S. ambassador. But those deals have held. These people got what they were promised. They have houses, and some of them are in political office. And they did what guerrillas around the world often do, which was they decided to come off the battlefield and try to pursue their goals by political argument. Now, some of these former Taliban still espouse the same ideas they espoused when they were in office, but they now do so peacefully. So the real answer to your question is to try to convert significant formations of Taliban guerrillas and leaders from armed insurrection to political participation. That would be the purpose of the talks.
Is the U.S. going behind Karzai's back to hold these talks?
No, they're briefing him. As I understand it, they give him regular descriptions of how the talks are going and what was discussed last time. And I understand that Karzai has his own lines of information to the same people that the Americans are talking to. And somebody told me that that Karzai feels that he gets better information from the Taliban about how the talks are going than he does from the Americans. Huh. But the Americans do give him briefings. So I don't think he feels especially anxious about this. Actually, I think this tends to his benefit because if something came together, he would be in the lead and he would have the support of the United States and other international governments. And that would strengthen his position. I think the people who are more nervous are the Pakistani government, Pakistani army. It's also getting briefings, but feels a little bit cut out of the process in general. They would prefer to be the agents for the Taliban in these negotiations. And the United States, by talking directly, is essentially going around them.
As the al-Qaeda and bin Laden expert that you are, having written two books, what's the Taliban relationship with al-Qaeda at this point?
Well, it's a disputed question. And it sort of depends on which part of the Taliban you're talking about. The Quetta Shura, the Afghan Taliban, as they're often referred to, which is where these exploratory talks, so far as I know, are most heavily located, has the least active and the most distant relationship with al-Qaeda of the various important Taliban groupings. There is another group whose name you often see in the newspapers, the Haqqani Network, which is a semi-independent faction of Afghan Taliban in North Waziristan, who notionally are loyal to Mullah Omar and the Quetta Shura, but in fact are a power unto themselves. They have a much richer historical and current overlap with al-Qaeda on the Pakistani side of the border. And then there are the Pakistani Taliban, which obviously blend in with some of the Afghan Taliban, whose purpose is to overthrow the government of Pakistan, and they also clearly have rich connections to al-Qaeda. So it's a bit of a soup. But there are elements of the Afghan Taliban whose interests and history suggest that they might be willing to break with al-Qaeda formally, which is a demand of the United States in these talks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Steve Call, president of the New America Foundation and a staff writer for The New Yorker. He has kind of a scoop in The New Yorker this week about the U.S. holding exploratory talks with elements of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And Steve, I gather you're writing a book now about oil, and here we are watching oil prices hit $100 a barrel with predictions of $5 gasoline and maybe a double-dip recession, and Gaddafi threatening to set fire to the oil fields in Libya rather than go down himself. Do you take that threat seriously?
Well, I don't know how to read Gaddafi anymore. I mean, your descriptions in the lead-in sort of sound like a Mad Magazine cartoon with Gaddafi and Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe collaborating as the as the castles around them burn. I think that Gaddafi has demonstrated, if you just don't listen to the wackier sort of phrases that he sometimes utters, he is very plugged in. He seems to watch a lot of news media, and so he throws around names and ideas almost like sort of a cranky guy who's watching a lot of too much satellite television. But if you look at his record, it's one of pretty consistent willingness to use ruthless violence to suppress revolts. He's killed more than 1,000 of his citizens before to put down rebellions over the last 15 or 20 years. It's obvious that he's issued orders through his sons to various militias, bodyguards, and mercenaries to show no quarter and to put all demonstrations and rebels down. So I don't doubt his intent. The rebellion will turn on the decisions of security force commanders at various levels, their willingness to fight and die for the revolution and to break from Gaddafi and risk being on the losing side. It's remarkable that there have been as many defections as there have been already, but essentially a civil war is setting up between East and West, and it's not clear who's going to move on the other side first and who has the most guns and planes and committed fighters.
Do you have a sense of who the other side to Gaddafi would be in a Libyan civil war and who they would be relative to the United States?
Well, the latter question is harder to answer. I mean, Gaddafi has used the threat of Islamists just as other secular authoritarians in the Maghreb and in the Middle East have done as a way to justify his dictatorship. There are, in fact, Libyan Islamists. They've been so decimated by Gaddafi that they are not currently a large formation, but they would certainly seek to join the rebellion. I think mainly this is an uprising against corruption and despotism. It's just a revolt against the system by many Libyans who feel that it is unjust, who are left out, who don't have a piece of it or who imagine a better Libya. And so I think you have, as you see in Tunisia and Egypt, a very broad coalition that is now forming in the revolt. It includes tribal leaders, it includes military officers, it includes technocrats in the oil industry, civil servants, and others. If they succeeded, there would be a question, as there is now in Tunisia and Egypt, as to what the revolution becomes and who leads it and on the basis of what ideology. But that's way down the line in this case, because they'd first have to win the war, and there's still a lot of, I'm afraid, blood that may be shed.
So you're saying too early to speculate on implications for the strength of al-Qaeda?
Yeah, I mean, there's no particular reason to worry about Libya in that respect, in comparison to, say, Egypt, where the Muslim Brotherhood has a long history of ideological sympathy for some of al-Qaeda's ideas. And where it's much more numerous. I mean, look, Egypt's a country of 85 million. Libya's a country of 6 million. It's unlikely that Libya would be seized by Islamists in some coup d'etat and turn the country over to al-Qaeda, because the West would not tolerate such a sanctuary. And So I'm not especially anxious about that.
Steve Call, president of the New America Foundation and a staff writer for The New Yorker, my guest on WNYC. People are calling in. I want to take a few phone calls for you at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, whether on Steve's scoop on the U.S. talking with members of the Taliban in Afghanistan in The New Yorker this week, or his knowledge of oil and the Middle East, 212-433-9692. But I want to play you a clip, Steve, of President Obama, who spoke yesterday about the violence in Libya, and I want you to listen to his tone as well as his words.
I've also asked my administration to prepare the full range of options that we have to respond to this crisis. This includes those actions we may take and those we will coordinate with our allies and partners, or those that we'll carry out through multilateral institutions. Like all governments, the Libyan government has a responsibility to refrain from violence, to allow humanitarian assistance to reach those in need, and to respect the rights of its people. It must be held accountable for its failure to meet those responsibilities and face the cost of continued violations of human rights.
So I think, Steve, unlike in the Egypt situation, the president sounds to me like he's laying down some demands for Muammar Gaddafi. But when the president talks about the full range of options, what do you think that realistically includes? Some people are discussing imposing a no-fly zone over Libya, for example, like the U.S. had over Iraq when Saddam Hussein was in power between the two Gulf Wars. Do you see anything like that as realistic, and would it have to involve U.S. warplanes?
I don't think it's imminent. A proper debate inside the administration monitoring events in Libya about what options they have to apply to the current violations of human rights that are being carried out by the Libyan regime, and what additional options they might look at if the regime's violence against its own citizens became even worse or dramatically worse. There are certainly, important advisors of the president, like Samantha Power, who wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book about the duty to protect, the duty to defend civilian populations in genocidal or near-genocidal situations.
Yes.
And I'm sure that some of her ideas are part of the discourse, along with the more traditional foreign policy view that, it would be counterproductive or unwise to intervene in a situation like this. So right now, I think there is an effort to persuade the Libyan government that it is in its own interest to show restraint. And that's about as far as the president went. He didn't say Gaddafi has lost his right to rule by the violence he has already carried out, or he has just observed that there have seemed to have been large-scale human rights violations, and the United States is going to, and the Europeans are saying the same thing, hold the government accountable, but also at the same time urge restraint over the next days and weeks.
So, listeners, we have a poll question on our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. This is getting a little ahead of the game, but not that much, of what the discussion is right now. Should the international community, involving U.S. warplanes if necessary, impose a no-fly zone over Libya to stop Muammar Gaddafi from bombing and strafing protesters? We want your opinions. Should the international community, involving U.S. warplanes if necessary, impose a no-fly zone over Libya to stop Gaddafi from bombing and strafing protesters? Register your response at our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. Michael in Park Slope, you're on WNYC with Steve Call. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, hey. It's great to be on with Mr. Call. I was calling with a question about the situation in Pakistan with an American named Raymond Davis, and whether Mr. Call had any particular insight into that incident and what might have been really going on there, and obviously what it means for CIA-ISI relationship that seems to be in crisis now.
Michael, thank you. And with your background, Steve, you wrote the book for which you were first on the show, I think, 7 years ago, Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, from the Soviet invasion to September 10th, 2001. What do you think about the Raymond Davis situation?
Well, it's a mess, and from what I hear, it's, right now it's completely stuck and may become quite a serious source of rupture in, already pretty troubled U.S.-Pakistani relations. I don't know exactly what happened on that corner. Obviously, Raymond Davis has been identified as a CIA officer or contractor or something of that sort, and his job has been described as one of chasing around and monitoring militant groups in the Punjab province of Pakistan. It's interesting from a intelligence operations perspective. He was clearly declared to the Pakistanis. In other words, he was not so deep undercover that it was that we were trying to hide his role from the Pakistanis. So they knew who he was. Mm-hmm. Now, that raises the question of whether their spy service was following him around, trying to keep tabs on him, suspicious about what he might really be up to, whether ISI officers were present at the scene. Was this just a robbery? Was there something else going on? I don't know. But those are questions that you would ask from the evidence we have. I think the larger picture is that there's a real danger that if they do not honor the immunity request that the United States is making under international law, the Pakistani government, that is, that the U.S. Congress will step in and defund substantial parts of USAID to Pakistan in retaliation. And, you know, this is already a pretty fragile relationship. And
so this right may now, have more implications for the U.S. safety for al-Qaeda than the talks we're holding with the Taliban, would you say?
Conceivably, if it leads to a prolonged and material rupture in cooperation between the U.S. and Pakistani government, yes.
One more question. David in Windsor Terrace has a question about your Taliban article. David, hi, real quick.
Yes, good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking the call. My question is about the implications for Afghan society if the Taliban are brought back to Afghanistan. The education and the situation with women's rights was criticized strongly when the Taliban were in power.
So the implications for women's rights, Steve, of the U.S. talking with the Taliban and maybe taking some back into the political process?
Yes. Well, it's a subject of great concern and anxiety to many Afghans, especially women and other groups that either were repressed by the Taliban or resented their cultural and educational and other policies. That's why Karzai formed this, what you'd call in the United States, a multi-stakeholder peace council with lots of different representatives, including women's and human rights groups representatives, to participate in this process if it unfolds. I think, you know, there are Taliban who have come in to politics without undermining the rights that women and school-going children have won since 2001. At the same time, if you've got a serious group of Taliban who wanted to make a big deal, they would certainly negotiate on justice and cultural issues of this type. I would make one last observation. The Taliban have learned that their policies about girls' education are something that has deeply isolated them in the world. And they've actually adjusted a little bit. They now actually covertly license schools in areas that they control. Now, the curriculum, you and I might not appreciate, but the point is that they're sentient about the fact that they have that they're isolated on this issue. And it would be a subject that they would talk about.
One more thing before you go. On oil, today's New York Times doesn't say Libya has cut off any oil flows. It says multinational oil companies have curtailed production in Libya. Their choice, not Libya's, by implication. Also, the U.S. gets hardly any oil from Libya and doesn't need the so-called sweet crude that Libya produces like Europe does. So I'm just curious, why are prices here going up so much? Is it just fear?
Well, yes, but, you know, the global oil market is a big liquid integrated market where it's all events are connected down the chain. It's not like the natural gas market where things are carved up into regional supply and demand equations. Here, it's like one big global bathtub where all the oil pours in from different spigots and pricing is a function of global supply.
But in that global bathtub, we also have the Saudis saying they'll pick up any slack if anything is lost from Libya. So I am scratching my head a little bit about why gasoline is going
Well, look, you've got these future markets now where there's a lot of hot money that just speculates on political events that could affect supply and demand equations. So you get these kinds of short-term speculative trades where people are are making big bets on how oil supplies will be perceived rather than what the underlying structure really is. So
right.
I think it does suggest, though, that overall supply and demand as the global economy recovers is getting a little bit tight again. So when you get a disruption around one supplier here or, say, in Nigeria or someplace else where violence can spike, you do get sharp movements in price.
Steve Call is president of the New America Foundation, a staff writer for The New Yorker. He has an article with a scoop this week on the U.S. talking to elements of the Taliban in Afghanistan. He's written two books on bin Laden. So I guess, by the way, as you take your leave, this AP story from this morning that says Gaddafi says bin Laden is behind the uprising in Libya, and al-Qaeda followers give young Libyans hallucinogenic pills in their coffee to get them to revolt. I guess in all your reporting, you never came across the bin Laden Magic Mushrooms Network?
I've come across bin Laden guerrillas, and I've come across guerrillas who take hallucinogens, but have I seen the twain meet that way.
Steve Call, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, take care.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, a special open phones for the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission Chairman, Phil Angelides. Everything you always wanted to know about the housing and banking collapse but had no one to ask. Stay with us.